And welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Brian Keller.
I'm Dan Fernandez.
Hi, Dan.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Let's just get right into it.
Let's get right into it.
Oh, geez.
Yes.
WCF Data Services 5.0 RTM release. So,
data.
Exactly. So, includes several client server features and libraries for .NET 4, Silverlight 4, and so on. Key thing here is a lot of new features, and you know, people can read it, but being able to add things like actions, for example, like a checkout action where I'm passing in JSON that says, you know, the things that I'm checking out in, say, a shopping cart scenario. Ability to define things as collections of data. So if we say, for example, have alternate emails, you can design that and have that be certain primitives.
So the idea of WCF Data Services is I have a data source that I want to expose as an OData
sure.
source. Okay, got it.
Sure. This is, again, their V5 release. I should have given context to bring this over there. And then other features, queryable via any and all, and a bunch of other new features that, you know, if you're building OData Services, you're probably going to want to look at.
All right.
Cool.
Sounds good. So the next story is Windows 8 and the Windows Phone SDK. So there have been a lot of questions about whether or not, number one, whether or not you can run the Windows Phone SDK on the Windows 8 consumer preview.
That we have discussed before.
We've talked about that before. And then there's also a question about whether or not applications that you build for Windows Phone 7 or 7.1 or 7.1.1 are going to run on Windows Phone in the future. And so they're coming out and saying two things. One is that, yes, you can use Windows Phone SDK 7.1.1 on Windows 8. It's not officially supported, per se, but because Windows 8 itself is not officially supported.
Sure.
But you can do it. And then the other thing they're saying is that applications you build today for Windows Phone 7 will continue to work on Windows Phone in the future, which is great.
Cool.
Yeah. And of course, there's a lot of people asking, you know, give us details on future versions of Windows Phone.
Yes, please give us exactly what your operating systems for the next 12 to 18 months will include.
Right. So, you heard it here first. It's going to be, no.
We'll save that for next story,
yes.
Tagline performance killers, common performance problems with Metro-style apps. So, this is from the Windows 8 app dev blog. And the idea is to basically go through really sort of three sections. General guidance. So if you can include things in your package locally, do that. Scale local images to the right size. So let's say I have, if I have images, I shouldn't be, you know, scaling or rescaling these images because that can be, from a performance perspective, costly. Mm-hmm. If you're doing things like thumbnails, you can use the built-in thumbnails versus you sizing them, say in an image, setting the height and width where it's sizing there versus using some of the OS features, just performance tips on how to handle network operations, what to do at startup, and then specific things around JavaScript that people may not be familiar with. Like, for example, that if you can run something in JavaScript by itself, it's faster than, say, hitting the DOM because they're in separate processes, and things that jump back and forth can be costly.
Sure.
And maybe that's different than, say, certain web behaviors and so on. So, and as well as XAML tips.
Okay.
So improving performance around certain XAML scenarios. So if something isn't visible, if you can take it out or hide it, that way it doesn't have to worry about rendering.
Right, so it's not off-screen doing a bunch of rendering and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
right?
So if I have 10,000 objects on my screen, if I can eliminate, say, 3,000 because they're not visible,
right.
That's just going to improve performance. And ways to use the compositor, the composition thread, and ways that you can actually not be on the UI thread and on the composition thread. Things that are probably somewhat familiar to people building Windows Phone 7 applications.
I mean, those are good performance tips for almost any type of application that you would be building, but it just sounds like, when we moved a new paradigm, we typically just focus on getting things working as opposed to making sure that they necessarily work fast. So it's a good reminder to kind of go back to some of those techniques.
Sure.
Okay.
So this is how to create a WinRT WRL C++ component. And the idea here is you want to basically be able to build objects that use WinRT, and basically what they've done is create and use the Windows Runtime Template Library, which is the WRTL part. This basically goes through how you build a WinRT component DLL. So the idea is if you build a WinRT component DLL using types that are usable by WinRT, mm-hmm. then it can actually be used in C# and in JavaScript as well.
Okay.
Or in the Windows JavaScript HTML5 programming model. So a lot okay. of people are, and I suspect there's going to be a lot of people building reusable libraries, mm-hmm. so they're going to want this information.
Now, is this the same as building a portable class library, or?
No, I think it's really, say that, you know, WinRT is itself built in C++. Say you wanted to build your own WinRT C++ DLL that can be reused across all the different languages, mm-hmm. whether in C++, C# or JavaScript, this is how you do it. So the okay. types are shared. You're not doing something weird that
forces marshaling or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically the ways to do that.
Okay.
So,
cool. So preemptive analytics in Visual Studio. So this is a blog post that Brian Harry made, and I believe I've talked a little about this before, but a lot of people may still be news to them. So the idea here is that preemptive, you know those guys, they built the Dotfuscator product for many years.
Yeah, and a lot of people know them from their analytics tool, which is used in CodePlex as well.
Right. So the idea is that you're an ISV, or maybe you deploy a bunch of applications out to a data farm somewhere, and you don't always have insight into what happens after you deploy those applications. You know, what bad things are happening, exceptions that are being thrown and caught and what have you, and also good things like which features are being used the most. And,
sure.
and for Visual Studio, there's, you know, 10 different ways to launch the debugger. How are people most likely launching the debugger when they're in the wild, right? Well, you know, maybe you like to do that.
I do wonder how many people click the play button versus mm-hmm. F5.
Yeah.
That's what I'd want to see. I'd want to see like a huge chart, and every day there'd be like a competition.
Yeah, or like a macro, run a macro.
There's issues with macros.
Anyway, the point
which we talked about.
We talked about that last week. The point being that it's helpful to have this information as a developer, whether you're planning for the next version or just doing bug fixes for an existing version. And so preemptive, based on their low-level understandings of being able to kind of decompile, insert additional analytics, and then recompile your applications, they're able to instrument your applications in such a way that you can start to gather that data. So we partnered with them so that you can get all that information now back into TFS, and the free version that you get with TFS now in TFS 11 allows you to capture exceptions data, and then you can buy additional packages from them that allow you to capture what we would call SQIM data within Microsoft, which is how many people use this feature versus that feature and the feature path kind of stuff.
Cool. This tool, Brian Peake mentioned it, and I had seen it, Sync Fusion Metro Studio. So it's available for free. You do have to register. But what it is a set of 600 icons, 600 icons available in different categories. And it's a little editor, and it's a great little editor that allows you to choose whether you're doing square, choosing the background color, and then choosing the foreground color with a series of images. And you can see here I've built a square icon with white on a sort of a purplish blue Visual Studio.
Very nice. It's good. I like it.
Thank you. You can add certain padding. You can mm-hmm. resize the image, and it has default sizes. And the cool part is you can either save it as a PNG, mm-hmm. so say if you need it for, say, Windows Phone mm-hmm. app bar, or you can use straight XAML. So if you can do things like, say, Windows 8 where you want to use something like XAML so that you it'll automatically resize and rescale correctly.
Now, that's really
being
cool.
Being vector-based.
Now, do you know how, if I wanted to make that a dynamic color based on kind of the theme that my Windows Phone user had picked for their phone, can I do that with this, or do I need to ship like 15 different images for...
So if it's in XAML, uh-huh. what you'd have to do is look at the XAML and see what the four color
okay.
is, set that as a property, and then you could even have your own app where somebody changes it, or just pick up the user's accent color.
Cool.
So it's certainly possible for areas where it's not where you haven't used it as a PNG. Mm. If it's in XAML, you can programmatically change it.
That's awesome. That's really
it's
cool.
It's just a property.
Yeah, it's just a property.
So what's this?
Yeah, so this is a show that our friend Brady Gaster did, and he interviewed Saeed over on the I guess he's on the WCF team, And they talked about like easy ways that you can do web and database deployment with Visual Studio 11. So he talks about how one of the challenges, of course, is you deploy your database for the first time, and then when you go to do subsequent, you know, incremental updates, it's not always easy to do that because you need to generate the Delta scripts and everything else. And so with the new Entity Framework advancements that they've made and mm-hmm. some of the web deploy stuff that you have, this is an article that's just focused on how do you do deployment and not just get your Hello World up and running, but actually how do you deal with existing deployments and updating them and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I love your shirt. At first I thought it was a unicorn because you started talking about Entity Framework. I thought it was like a repeating theme, but it looks actually a goat with sunglasses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's what that is.
Yeah,
a little
full screen.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot more sense. Okay.
Totally makes more sense.
Is it a goat or a ram?
I think it's...
That's a ram.
That's a ram.
That's definitely a ram. That, now it makes sense.
Now it makes sense.
Got it. All right, next story.
Next story. Event flashback. So, Lang.next, there's been a ton of content posted on Channel 9. This was a session from Mads Torgersen, who we, of course, love. A
great presenter.
So Mads goes through thinking about language support for asynchronous programming and, of course, applying it with C#, kind of giving the roadmap of C#. Mm-hmm. A lot of this stuff is probably similar to, say, his build talk. Mm. But really, it kind of goes through the issues with asynchronous, not having asynchronous, where you end up with this spaghetti callback code where I'm calling, then I'm calling something else, then I'm calling the next execution, and you end up as a developer, and a lot of the things that they did to make the async stuff and the wait really nice and beautiful and intuitive from a language perspective.
So you're not calling all the time.
You are calling, but the language is nice. It lets you know when it's done, and then you can get the next level of execution.
I'm
awaiting a response. I can do things like await any. So if I only need to, I call five things. Whoever the first one is, you're going to do it. Or I can await all. Don't do anything until all of them are done, and then do a specific task. Mm-hmm. Doing a delay. You know, just playing around after 5 seconds, then do this one where you're doing more sequences of items.
That's cool. I had no idea you had that level of flexibility. That's great.
Yeah. It's kind of awesome.
All right. So speaking of flexibility, I don't know a good way to segue this, but partying with Palermo here, we have, he pointed out that the W3C recently published a delta between HTML4 and HTML5. So if you're trying to wrap your head around all the changes that are coming in HTML5 and you kind of know HTML4, as a starting point, this is a really good way to do that. Just click on over to the link provided there.
The aside tag, which I didn't know about, tangential content. That's kind of funny.
What is that for?
Like, I guess to do an aside.
Yeah?
There's an actual tag for it.
I wonder how that's supposed to be used.
I think it should be a meta tag. Aside. The aside tag is funny. Aside.
Oh, that's hilarious. And did they bring Blink back?
They did not.
It's probably just assumed. So...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we can always block code and write. We can do that in Canvas, actually.
Oh,
everything's Canvas
that's right.
Now.
That's right. That's true.
Sweet.
Picks of the week. So my pick of the week has, I mean, it's not directly, you know, tied into technology, but I just love this. A lot of our viewers may have already seen this, but this is basically a 9-year-old kid down in East LA that spent the last summer working in his dad's garage and kind of keeping himself busy on the weekends by building all these cardboard arcade games. And so he like has the little claw that goes down and like grabs prizes.
He designed all the different
He designed
games.
All the stuff. And if you watch the video, he also has this little built-in security mechanism, which is kind of like a CRC check, where you can buy a fun pass. And a fun pass gives you 500 plays, so it's a really valuable thing. It costs $2, and to make sure that people had valid fun passes, he takes a really big number and then he does a square root of that, and then he gets some other number. And what he does is he writes that down on the card to verify that when you walk over to the calculator and you type the really big number and press this, that you actually get the number that's on the card, so that people can't walk in with fake fun passes, which is, of course, a big problem.
You just have to watch the video.
You do. You really have to watch the video. I mean, I love
this
kid.
Awesome.
I want to hire him, like, tomorrow. I don't think he's old enough, but he's just a really heartwarming story.
Yeah, I love that story.
Yeah.
It was great. So, my pick of the week is Project Detroit. So, our first CodePlex project, and this is specifically to the onboard diagnostic system. So the idea here is you buy an OBD2 cable, and we do list the cable on the right part of the article, which is over. Yeah, we can't. Yeah, down there in the blue part. So you buy the serial cable, plug it in via USB, mounts as a COM port, tell the COM port, and then you switch it and boom, you start the app when your car is running and you can read onboard diagnostic data.
So what kinds of cars support this?
So it depends. Almost all cars past 1992.
Really?
Or so.
So you're telling me they have serial ports that I can just plug into?
No, they have an onboard diagnostic port.
Okay, so I need onboard, to get that adapter first.
You need to get an adapter. Yes, that's the thing that I was telling you that you have to buy.
Okay.
You buy a cable. That's where, like, if you go to a regular car store,
yeah,
switch the underneath your car, and we have a picture of this in the article. There's a little plug. You plug it in there, and then you plug the other part into your. It's a USB connector.
Like underneath the, it's. I'd find this under the hood, under the dash.
Under
most of the time, I mean.
Yeah. So it's right in the article, but you can't see since this is a screenshot.
Yeah.
But right underneath the wheel, along the top. Here's the driver wheel. Mm-hmm. Here's the wheel well where gas pedals are in here. It's along the top.
Okay.
There's a big plug thing. You plug that in. The other side is the USB that plugs into your computer.
And so, what type of stuff do I learn about?
So it depends. So all different cars support different PIDs. There's a huge list of PIDs, from diagnostic PIDs to just regular PIDs, and those would be things like RPM,
okay,
fuel level,
okay,
type of fuel,
type of fuel.
Yes,
it'll tell me what type of fuel is in my gas tank.
Yes.
Wow.
If it's actually supported. Again, not all cars support everything. Speed. The speed is in kilometers, by the way. Hilarious story. I'm like, oh my god, the code is broken because it has me doing 100 on 520, and of course that is a pretty reasonable speed to be doing on 520.
I wouldn't put it past you.
100 kilometers. So right. Other things that you can use. I'm just trying to think of.
And are there right operations? Can you reprogram your car with this stuff?
No, it's really to know what your car is doing.
Okay, got it.
So, and there's other things. For example, like if you really want to do this and say replace your dash, there's things that you're gonna have to do manually. Mm. So, for example, like if you turn your turn signal on, that's not coming from the engine. This is like reading data directly from the engine.
Right.
Turn signal has nothing to do with that, right? So it's just an electrical relay that turns a light on and off.
Okay, so you've
got to do that. Yeah, so you can use like a fidgets controller and say when the light's on, then turn the PC on and stuff like that. Huh. So, but it's kind of interesting to know how all these different pieces like fit together.
Yeah, that's really cool. So did you and Clint, when you were down there for West Coast Customs, did you research this on your own, or were you working with their guys and they told you here's what you need to do?
No,
or?
So Wikipedia was probably the best resource. Brian Peake actually did the library, and really it was just parsing data that comes from it and understanding the format that it comes in. Hmm. And there's certain performance tips. So, for example, you probably don't want to wait for all... Because if you're parsing a bunch of these data, just the way that it comes across the serial port, it can actually be a long time. Like, really, you want your speed to be really fast, right? Like, if I have a speedometer, it should be as fast as possible, like, from an accuracy perspective. Huh. But you don't necessarily, your fuel level...
You don't need to read that every 30 seconds, yeah.
Yeah, you can read that every... I mean, even every 1 second versus every 20 milliseconds,
right?
So those sort of things that you can make decisions on which... how you want to pull, how you want to... get intervals for data.
Got it. Tangential topic. Did you see the post that Scott Hanselman made about, he said, my car ships with crapware this week? Okay, you should go read that post. Maybe we'll get Greg to link to it from the show notes as well. But he posted his frustrations with all the, like, in-dash systems today and how in order for him to, like, stream Pandora, he's got to jump through, like, 12 different steps to make that happen, and he's got to pair it with his phone, and it's going to be outdated in 10 years because, you know, Pandora may not even be around and there's no app store for his Toyota. And yeah, it's just a really interesting read. But clearly a space with a lot of potential, a lot of interesting things to do.
And TVs and cars. Those are the two app platforms of the future.
Yes, exactly. So we'll see you next week when Dan will have reinvented the car.
No.
All right.